Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for, and what is the date today? September 5th, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two guests scheduled for tonight. First, I'll speak with political economist Sungur Savran, who is Turkish in origin and right now living in Istanbul, although he spent a lot of time in New York. I interviewed him about 6-7 months ago about economic and political crisis in Turkey, and things have only gotten worse since then. So we'll get an update. And also, Turkey is on the front line of any likely war with Iraq, and we'll ask Sungur Savran about the politics of that in Turkey and in the region. And then we'll speak with the economist Heather Boucher, frequent guest here. Heather is the co-author of The State of Working America, just out from the Economic Policy Institute there. Look at the material welfare of the population of the United States, which they publish every 2 years on Labor Day. And before we get to our first guest, the Brookings Institution, which is, as a friend of mine once said, a graveyard for conservative Democrat pundits, put out a study the other day. Bigger they are, the harder they fall, an estimate of the costs of the crisis in corporate governance. And what they're really talking about is the collapse in the stock market and all the various accounting and business and management scandals that collapse has revealed, particularly, of course, the headline names like WorldCom and Enron and such. But they're trying to put some kind of dollar estimate on the economic damage from the market fall and the crisis in confidence. And I'm not entirely sure I agree with their theorizing. They forget that what preceded that collapse was a bubble and an overstimulation and a wild excessive expansion in the financial sector and a good bit of the real economy. They overlook that part and just look at the downside. They also assume that it's just a matter of a lack of trust among investors that's causing all the problems and not some larger economic and political forces. But anyway, it's an interesting exercise, and they estimate that if the stock market pretty much stays where it is in this zone now, the crisis will lower GDP in the United States by $35 billion a year. And for comparative purposes, they say this is the range of what the federal government spends per year or proposes to spend a year on so-called homeland security, or the same as a $10 increase in the price of oil. So it is a substantial hit as a result of this market decline. But amusingly, they have a rather nasty table in here, which they call the many roads to failure. And remember, this is Brookings Institution is not entirely, but skews to the Democratic side of politics. The many roads to failure. January 22, Bush speech assails Enron executives who heavily contributed to his campaign. Stock market reaction down 0.73%. Then SEC Chair Harvey Pitt announces proposal to require CEO certification of annual report. Market falls 0.08%. House passes on April 24. House passes weak bill on accounting regulation, down 0.15%. SEC unanimously approves auditor oversight system, down 1.34%. July 9th, Bush gives speech on Wall Street, just down the street from where I'm sitting right now, outlining proposals to deal with the crisis. Market falls 2.5%. Sarbanes bill passes on July 9, 2002, tightening corporate management and accounting regulations. This was introduced in the Senate, not passed. And the market reaction down 3.4%. And then July 15 and 16, in succession, the Senate unanimously passed that Sarbanes bill. And Fed Chair Alan Greenspan gives speech to Senate Banking Committee that is upbeat on economy. Market reaction down almost 2%. The real meaning of all that is that at least the financial markets don't seem to have much faith in what the government is doing to improve the reputation and honesty of our own financial markets. And every time somebody opens his mouth, and they're all he's in this case, the market seems to fall. And the president seems to have among the worst luck in that regard. Every time he opens his mouth, the market falls. And I think people who are not in the market, their jaws drop in aghast at the stupidity of whatever is emerging from his mouth. And now we should be joined by Sungur Savran, a political economist who is based in Istanbul. And we spoke with him, I think, around February, maybe broadcast the interview in February or maybe early March, about what was going on in Turkey, and it was none so good then. And we've heard a lot about economic troubles in Latin America, but Turkey is up there with them, and also a very politically crucial country for U.S. security policy and such. So it's important to see what's going on there. Welcome to WBAI, Sungur Savran.
Hello, Doug. Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you.
And thank you for staying up to midnight and to talk to us and our listeners.
Well, good to talk to a New York audience for me, where I have many friends.
Okay, so when we talked in February, the Turkish economy was in bad shape, the political system was creaking with crisis. Have things gotten any better, or have they gotten worse?
Well, for the moment, the economy seems to be almost frozen, waiting to see what's going to happen on the political scene, because early elections have been called because of deep crises within the Turkish political system, especially the rifts between the divisions within the Turkish ruling classes, political forces. But overall, of course, the crisis is continuing despite all the lift up that the government is trying to make people believe that the situation is better. We should note that the Turkish lira is now standing after 1.5 years after the February 2001 financial crash at one-third what its parity was back then. The GDP contracted by almost close to 10% in 2001. Things are going a bit better on that front simply because exports have risen, but inside the country, the domestic economy is still suffering from the same problems. Unemployment is still going up further, and 1.5 million people have been laid off in the 18 months that have gone by, and that is within a workforce that is around 21 million people and with a very high structural unemployment to start with. And incomes have plummeted. I'll give you just one indication, and that is the minimum wage now stands at 180 million Turkish lira, which is around $100 to $110, because Turkish lira is fluctuating constantly, which means, for our listeners, given the long hours that the workers with a minimum wage work, around an hourly wage of around 40 cents. So Turkey has become one of those very low-wage economies that one constantly keeps talking about.
Well, by the usual classifications, Turkey is considered a middle-income country, sort of on a par with Mexico. So 40 cents an hour is really quite a crash, isn't it?
I know. This is, of course, the minimum wage, and we should not be led into the mistaken idea that all workers, of course, receive that kind of wage. But nonetheless, we should not forget that these are the subcontractors that work for the big firms that are the partners of the multinational companies in Turkey. So that, of course, it's not only the small employers who benefit from this kind of, you know, sweatshop condition, plus low wages, but also the big firms and the corporations and the multinationals too. I agree with you that for Turkey that sounds very low, but then we must remember also that after the 10% fall in GDP last year, Turkey has now been moved by the World Bank from the upper middle income, from among the upper middle income countries to the lower income middle income countries. So it has been demoted, so to speak, within that range of middle income countries, of course. The economy overall is still very fragile. For one thing, domestic plus foreign debt is very high. It's almost 1.5 times gross domestic product. Also, the banking system is still very shaky. we must remind our audience that almost around 20 banks have collapsed within the space of 2 years and taken over by a government, which in fact was very adamantly trying to privatize what was left of the public financial sector in Turkey. So that's quite an irony you have there. The banking system, despite these 20 banks that have been quasi-nationalized, is still very shaky, and that has been proved by the latest incident where two banks belonging to a group, a holding group, a big conglomerate, which is now the first conglomerate in Turkey, have collapsed, and one of them nationalized and the other one taken under public authority control. So that shows us what the situation is with respect to the banks. Moreover, there's of course the approaching war on Iraq, which probably will cause a lot of instability in the Turkish economy. On top of which is added the political instability. The election is coming up, but we'll probably have a chance to talk about this, will probably result in a very unstable kind of political setup. So that, you know, I don't see that the future holds very much that is good in store for the Turkish economy.
Now, let's before we move on, you said earlier that the currency, the Turkish lira, had collapsed. And I think a lot of listeners might find that alarming, but perhaps in an abstract way. What does it mean to a country when its currency collapses like that?
Well, the first thing that it means, of course, is that everything that is coated in foreign currency becomes very expensive in the currency of the country. Now, in a country like Turkey, which for the last 20 years at least has set up very close ties to the world economy, whose imports are very important, especially with respect to investment goods and intermediary goods, first and foremost oil, of course, that means rising prices. In effect, the audience, our audience may not remember that at the root of the crisis was a three-year IMF program, followed very, very loyally by the Turkish government in the year 2000, which explicitly wanted to bring down the rate of inflation from around 80% to down to 10% at the end of the 3 years. Then, at the end of the first year, the whole system collapsed under IMF guidance, and inflation rose to around 80% again from around 50%. So we see that this kind of result is, of course, very important. Secondly, because wages do not rise along with the prices of imported goods, and therefore the inflation rate, of course, this means that people get poorer and poorer all the time.
So the effect is like the whole country gets a wage cut, essentially.
Right, exactly. The whole country, the whole working population, at least. Also, of course, that sector of the capitalist class that really does not earn its revenues in currency, foreign currency, that is, sorry, loses a lot, relatively speaking, when compared to that part of the capitalist class, for instance, like exporters and those in the tourism industry, which is quite important in Turkey nowadays, who own foreign currency. They, of course, don't lose anything at all. So it's really the working population that gets harmed immensely.
I'm speaking with Sungur Savran, who is a political economist, speaking to us from Istanbul about the crisis in the Turkish economy. You mentioned the IMF program. Argentina certainly has gotten a lot of attention in this hemisphere. It was a very loyal student of the IMF, and everything went wrong. Is Turkey in a pretty similar situation?
Well, in the case of Turkey, it was as our audience probably knows, that in Argentina there was a currency board which tied the peso to the dollar on a one-to-one basis. In the case of Turkey, it was a quasi-currency board situation where the Turkish lira was tied to a basket of the dollar and the euro at a, you know, at a certain percentage. Now, what happened in Turkey is that the program came down very soon, that is, within the space of 1 year, while in Argentina, the country was declared to be the star, the rising star of the students, among the students of the IMF for at least 6 or 7 years. Now, in the case of, in the present situation, of course, the case of Turkey contrasts totally with Argentina. Argentina is now the odd man out. Probably our listeners know that Brazil was lately accorded $30 billion because there's the risk of the Workers' Party of Brazil coming to power with Lula at its head. And Uruguay was granted $1.5 billion by the American administration, which was supposed to be against bailing out countries, but Argentina was the odd man out, apparently being punished because it didn't pay its foreign debt. It certainly went on to say that it wasn't able to pay its foreign debt. In the case of Turkey, the IMF acted in a very different manner. Turkey went through two financial crashes in November 2000 and February 2001, and then had a third and probably what would have proved to be a conclusive one, a real depression-like situation would have come about in July 2001, had the IMF not intervened, had Stanley Fischer, the acting manager of the managing director, sorry, of the IMF, not visited Turkey and tried to calm fears, and the IMF finally had the IMF finally not accorded Turkey a $16 billion dollar package in November of the same year, 2001. Now, this, of course, this special treatment vis-à-vis Turkey derives totally from the Turkish role in the U.S. policy in the region from the Balkans to Central Asia. And I would say it's something like blood money, that is to say, money that is perhaps paid for the blood that is going to be spilled in the future by the soldiers of the Turkish army, because the Turkish army is really acting as one of the spearheads, if not the most important spearhead of the U.S. in the region, I would say. That is why there's such a difference between Argentina, the treatment of Argentina and Turkey by the IMF.
I want to return to this topic in a moment, but in 3 to 5 minutes, why is Turkey in such a grinding, crunching economic crisis? Is it just part of a larger world situation, or are there factors unique to the Turkish situation?
Well, I would say that the most important thing is that overall, over these 20 years, Turkey has tried to open up its economy, try to join the bandwagon of so-called globalization, and try to do this in a quite rapid manner. And on the basis of converting the Turkish lira into a convertible currency in 1989, what that causes in situations like this, I would say, is that the country the country's economy cannot bear the burden of this kind of competition with other currencies. And so, at a certain point, for a certain while, what is called hot money rushes into the country. And for that money to be kept inside the country, you have to keep the, and because the money comes in, that also happens by itself, on its own, you have to keep the value of the national currency high. But then at a certain stage, the economy, as I said, the real economy, the productive center, cannot bear the burden of that high rate of currency because that brings down the competitive force of the economy. So there are signs within the real sector, the productive sector, that things are not going so well. So the hot money withdraws, and then all of a sudden the country falls into a financial crash. The Turkish economy has had its ups and downs like this over periods of 2 years throughout the 90s. Now, on top of this, the IMF program wanted to harmonize the Turkish economy with the Maastricht criteria of the European Union, of which Turkey is a candidate for membership, for accession, and in a very rapid manner, which caused the whole thing to collapse, I think. That is the major thing, I think, the Turkish relation, contradictory relationship with the world economy and so-called globalization.
And now let's talk a bit about the political situation. Turkey is, of course, very important to the U.S. On several fronts, as you mentioned, the Balkans, the war on terrorism to the east, and the likely attack on Iraq. How's this all playing in Turkey? I mean, let's talk about Iraq, since that's the big issue of the day. I mean, what role is Turkey expected to play, and how do the Turkish people feel about it?
As you pointed out, we should underline the fact that the Turkish state and the Turkish bourgeoisie has been following a very aggressive, expansionist, and militaristic policy since the early 90s, since, that is, the Soviet Union collapsed or disintegrated. And, of course, since the war started in Yugoslavia. In the Balkans, it's following an irredentist policy of trying to provoke peoples who are relics of the Ottoman Empire in the Balkans. And to the east, that is in the Caucasus and Central Asia, is following a quasi-pan-Turkist policy of trying to act as the big brother of the Turkic peoples, which now have their independent republics in the Caucasus and Central Asia. In the Middle East, it is part of a tripartite alliance between the U.S., Israel, and Turkey, of course. And so in all these three directions, it's following a very aggressive policy, while in the past it was much more inward-turned from the point of view of foreign policy. Now, with respect to Iraq, that is the big thing, of course. But before going into that, let me remind our listeners that Turkey is now at the command of the International Security Assistance Force in Kabul. That is, it is, and this, I think, is a very vivid example of how Turkey is acting as one of the spearheads of U.S. policy in this whole region. It's taken over the command of the ISAF in Afghanistan. Now, with respect to Iraq, I would say the majority of Turkish society is against the war in Iraq. Islamists are against. Kemalists, who are the Turkish brand of nationalism, both right and left-wing Kemalists, are against. Socialists are against. Kurds are against. Even, I would say, the government itself is not for. And let me explain that a bit. Because, you see, Turkey has had its share of the Kurdish problem for the last two decades, as most of our listeners know very well. There was a guerrilla war waged by the PKK for 15 years, at the end of which the leader of the PKK was captured in Kenya by the probably the intelligence forces or the secret forces of the United States and turned over to Turkey and is now in jail. Which means that, of course, the war is to a certain extent over and the PKK has been following a much more pacific policy these last 3 years. However, the Kurdish movement in Turkey is still very strong. There is a parliamentary party which is not now in parliament for reasons we may go into later, but who may, at least under certain circumstances, enter parliament in the early elections of November the 3rd. So Turkey worries very much that in an independent Kurdish state may be established as a result of the Iraq war, or even it is even afraid of a federated Iraq state on the basis of ethnic groups, an ethnically based federation in Iraq. That is why even the Turkish government and the ruling classes are not very eager to go to join join the war effort in Iraq. However, and let me add this and stop there, perhaps you have other questions, however, because, first of all, the alliance with the U.S. is considered to be strategic by both the ruling classes and the Turkish military. Turkey has decided, I mean, the government has decided that it will go along as long as the U.S. decides to attack Iraq. And secondly, even if this weren't the case, Turkey is economically at such a vulnerable position that it does need U.S. support for any kind of IMF assistance, which means that even if it did not want to carry on its alliance, strategic alliance with the U.S., it probably would have to because of that.
And we've only got a minute or so left. Now, you mentioned elections coming up. What's likely to come out of that?
Okay. May I add for 1 minute something very important
to
what I said concerning Iraq? Because of this contradiction, the fear about the Kurdish state or Kurdish entity in northern Iraq and the alliance with the U.S., Turkey will probably enter, it has already started to enter, it has troops in northern Iraq, and probably will go, this will expand as the war starts, which means that there may be two different wars. One, the imperialist aggression, I would say, of the U.S. Or the allied forces, depending on the situation on Iraq. But secondly, a war between Turkey and some forces within northern Iraq, because especially, first of all, let me remind our listeners that the PKK still has thousands of guerrillas in northern Iraq. And secondly, lately, one of the major forces in northern, Kurdish forces in northern Iraq, that is the Democratic Party of Kurdistan of Barzani, has been much more outspoken in its criticism of Turkish intervention in Iraq. So this should be paid attention to very closely, I think. Now, with respect to elections, the whole thing, of course, is a result of the very many contradictions that traverse the Turkish, the political forces of the Turkish ruling bourgeoisie. Let me remind our listeners that all major political families in Turkey have now at least two or three political parties. So this is like a sort of, you know, situation where there are constant splits within parties. The center-right has two major parties, some upstarts. The center-left has so-called social democracy has three major parties. The Islamic movement has two major parties. And even the fascist movement, with its centralistic and despotic management, has three contending parties, although one of them is incomparably bigger. Now, all the polls show that the partly repented and partly revamped offshoot of the old Islamic Party, the so-called Justice and Development Party, AKP, has around 25% and will turn out to be the first party after in the elections. What's interesting is that in the second place is the CHP, the People's Republican Party, which is the founding party of the Republic, which turned supposedly into a social democratic party in the 70s, and which is now joined by Kemal Dervish, the ex-vice president of the World Bank, who happened to be a Turkish national and so was invited to take over the management of the Turkish economy after the crisis began, who is now a big name for international financial circles because he happens to be the executor of the IMF's will in Turkey, joined this party. And so the CHP, the People's Republican Party, which now has around 15% of the polls, seems to be a candidate for coming in second or perhaps even first as the propaganda period goes on, because it now seems to be an alliance between the anti-Islamic military of Turkey, on the one hand, and all its followers, and the big bourgeoisie and the policies of the IMF at the economic front. This is a very interesting situation because workers' leaders, you know, labor unions' leaders have also joined the party, so it now seems to be a kind of, you know, strange bedfellows in a so-called Social Democratic Party who has been very right-wing in its policies all throughout these last two decades, now acting as you know, the locus where IMF policies and labor union leaders who were supposedly against these IMF policies all throughout this period come together. Very, very strange situation. It seems the other parties are going to remain below the 10% threshold that is stipulated by the election law. That is to say, for a party to get deputies into representatives into parliament, it needs to receive 10% of the vote, nationally speaking.
I'm afraid we'll have to bring it to a close there, but we'll get back in touch as the election approaches. Thank you for joining us, Sundar Savran. Sundar Savran is a political economist who stayed up late to join us live from Istanbul. We, a couple of months ago, interviewed John Halley, who is a member of the Green Party on the City Council of New Haven, Connecticut. But John Halley's day job is as a professor of music at Yale, and he's a composer. And he set to music some words that were attributed to Lawrence Summers in a memo when he was the chief economist of the World Bank. They're actually written by a subordinate economist at the bank, Lant Pritchett. But they're quite a famous memo in which Summers/Pritchett suggested, "Just between you and me, shouldn't the World Bank be encouraging more migration of the dirty industries to the less developed countries? I can think of three reasons. One, the measurement of the cost of health-impairing pollution depends upon the foregone earnings from increased morbidity and mortality. From the point of view, a given amount of health-impairing pollution should be done in the country with the lowest cost, which will be the country with the lowest wages. I think the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest-wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. Two, the cost of pollution are likely to be nonlinear, as the initial increments of pollution probably have a very low cost. I've always thought that underpopulated countries in Africa are vastly underpolluted. Their air quality is probably vastly inefficiently low compared to Los Angeles or Mexico City. Only the lamentable facts that so much pollution is generated by non-tradable industries, transport, electrical generation, for example, and that the unit transport costs of solid waste are so high, prevent world welfare enhancing trade in air pollution and waste. Three, the demand for a clean environment for aesthetic and health reasons is likely to have very high income elasticity. That is, the higher income, the cleaner your environment you want. The concern over an agent that causes one in a million change in cases of prostate cancer, and that was wrong in the original, is obviously going to be much higher in a country where people survive to get prostate cancer than in a country where under 5 mortality rate is 200 per thousand. And it concludes, the problem with the arguments against all these proposals for more pollution in the less developed countries, intrinsic rights to certain goods, moral reasons, social concerns, lack of adequate markets, etc., could be turned around and used more or less effectively against every World Bank proposal for liberalization. When this memo was leaked to the press, it caused an enormous storm. It had no impact on Summers' career. He remained as chief economist of the World Bank, then became Secretary of the Treasury under Bill Clinton, and is now president of Harvard University. When you're a member of the elite, you can say the most outrageous things and get away with it. But John Halley set some of these words to music, and we're going to have him on in a little while when this is actually released in a commercial release, but I thought I'd play a little excerpt from the piece Mortgaging the Earth, written by John Halley and performed by the Chamber Ensemble Secretaire. Thank you. Economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in a lowish wage country is impeccable, and we should face up to that. The words appear to be the signature of Lawrence Summers, then chief economist of the World Bank, now president of Harvard University, and set to music by John Halley, professor of music at Yale University, and a Green member of the City Council. And when that actually achieves commercial release, we'll let you know. And I should say, this is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And we're now joined by Heather Boucher, who is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, and one of the three co-authors of The State of Working America, 2002-2003, which is an absolutely indispensable volume that comes out every 2 years, reviewing the material welfare of the population of the United States, work hours, poverty, income distribution, debts, assets, you name it, it's in here. And it will actually be published as a book by Cornell University Press on January 1st, but it's released to the media on Labor Day every Labor Day in even-numbered years. And welcome to WBAI, Heather Boucher.
Hello, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
So, The State of Working America, it was pretty good a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
And The State of Working America was good a couple of years ago, and it's really not as rosy right now.
Let's start with the better news, the historical news.
Well, the good news was that over the period between 1995 and 2000, the economy sustained low unemployment, which meant that most everyone who wanted a job was likely to get one. Led to historic lows in unemployment for minority workers, African-American workers, Hispanic workers, and also for low unemployment for workers with less education. All of that led to higher wage growth for workers across the income distribution, so that over that period in the late 1990s, we saw a slowing of income inequality for the first time in over 20 years. Workers at the bottom end of the income distribution saw their wages rise by over 10%, between 95 and 2000, as well as workers at higher levels of the income distribution. They also saw their wages rise, also nearly about 10%. So really, those were very good years for American workers. Jobs were plentiful, and wage growth was strong.
And that reversed some of the trends of the previous 20-some-odd years. I mean, the real average wage fell between 1973 and 1995, and you saw polarization. Even the boom in the 1980s, average workers didn't do so well. So it was really only the late 90s that things started looking up for the average Joe and Jane. And in
fact, it wasn't until 2001 that the average male worker saw his wages rise back to where they were in 1973. So really, it was not until the end of that five-year period that a lot of the damage that had been done between 73 and 95 started to become overcome. And especially with the income inequality, we didn't actually make any progress in reducing income inequality, but over that five-year period, it didn't grow anymore.
And this was mainly the result of the fact that the unemployment rate was very low, relatively low for a long period of time, lowest in a generation, and not a result of any specific government policies otherwise, was it?
Well, there was a couple of government policies, and the Federal Reserve kept interest rates somewhat low for a lot of that, especially some of the later years. There was also, we raised the minimum wage in 1996, which did have some effect on workers at the bottom, and there was, although there were many complicated implications of welfare reform, one of the positive things to come out of that was that there was an increase in spending on work supports, child care, and and the like for low-income families. So there were some policies that helped workers, but most of it was really the low unemployment and the strong productivity growth that we saw over that five-year period.
And, of course, now from most of us, that's a fading memory, right?
Those days are behind us. You know, right now, the unemployment rate at 5.9% is a full 2 percentage points higher than where it was 2 years ago. And we're already seeing signs that wage growth is slowing and that income inequality is rising again because wages are growing slower for workers at the bottom end of the wage distribution than for workers at the top, although wage growth has slowed across the board. We've also seen a rise in bankruptcies and American household debt is at historic levels. So really there's a lot of indications that things aren't as good for American families.
And when you were on here a couple months ago, we addressed this issue, but let's do it again. By a lot of conventional measures, the recession that may even be over in conventional senses was pretty mild. But the effects on workers has been considerably less mild, right?
Well, the interesting thing about this recession is that in many ways it looks similar to the recession of the early 1990s. However, the events of September 11th changed the composition of job losses this time around, so we lost many more jobs in the service sector and in transportation and retail trade than we did in the recession of the early 1990s. We're now in our, I think, 22nd month of consistently rising or higher unemployment, and all signs this week point to the new unemployment numbers will come out tomorrow morning. Pretty much every indication is that unemployment will rise from 5.9 up to maybe 6 or 6.1 tomorrow morning when the numbers come out. So this recession has been very long in terms of unemployment growth, like the one of the early 1990s, but it's been deeper for some segments, like I said, services, and this has had an effect on who's lost their job. Women have lost nearly double the amount of jobs this recession as they did in the recession of the early 1990s. Especially African-American women have been hit hard in this recession. So there are some differences. We've also lost more jobs overall in this recession at this point than we have in compared to the one in the early 1990s.
And one of the reasons the unemployment rate hasn't risen higher is that people have just dropped out of the workforce.
Yeah, school... graduate school enrollment is at record highs this fall, and a lot of folks have dropped out of the labor market and are not searching for work. And if you're not actively searching for work and you don't have a job, then you're not counted in the unemployment numbers. That's why typically we look at the change in the number of people who have jobs rather than just the rise in the unemployment rate when we're looking at how deep a recession is.
I'm speaking with Heather Boucher, a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute and one of the authors of EPI's State of Working America, which was released to the press on Labor Day and will be published as a book by Cornell University Press on January 1st. The classic recessions of the 50s, 60s, 70s into the 80s, usually men were much harder hit because more men were working in manufacturing. Manufacturing was a much more cyclical sector, and services were pretty much insulated, and women didn't suffer as much. It's been different this time around, hasn't it?
Definitely. It's been a lot different. Although one of the things that we saw at the beginning of the recession, starting in October of 2000, was that manufacturing was hit first, and we saw a great number of job losses from October of 2000 on forward. But typically, in previous recessions, the service sector has continued to see employment growth over the course of the recession. And that is one thing that we've seen not at all during this recession. Overall, the growth in the service sector has been less than a percentage point. And we actually saw a decline in the service sector after the events of September 11th. So whereas normally services act as a pull on demand, you know, they pull more people into jobs during a recession, we haven't seen that this time around, which has really, like I said before, changed the composition of who's lost their jobs. One of the other interesting things about this recession is that workers across the educational spectrum have been hit more equally during this recession than in any previous one. Usually it's folks without a high school degree or folks with a high school degree that are hit the hardest, but this time it's been relatively even among the different educational groups, which is, again, a result of the fact that services have been hit much harder. And I don't want to blame all of this on September 11th. I think that moment was a catalyst. We lost a lot of jobs immediately in the months after that. But this is following a long-term trend. During the recession in the early 1990s, we saw less service sector growth over the course of the recession than we did in previous ones. So this is a part of a trend towards a shifting in terms of how recessions occur.
And also to beat one of my favorite horses, the Wall Street folks have pressured companies to cut costs very quickly, which means cutting out, laying off lots of people very quickly, and a lot of people in middle management who had previously been insulated from these kinds of cyclical attacks.
We've definitely been seeing more middle managers losing their jobs this time around, which is interesting because we talked of the recession in the early 90s as the recession that was really hitting those folks, but it's actually happening again.
And let's go back to the boom a minute and talk about work effort. Certainly people saw incomes rise, but people are also working harder during that, weren't they? Longer hours?
Americans work longer hours than workers in any other developed country. We even work more hours than the country that we typically think of as more workaholic than us, the Japanese. There's really no place else that people put in more hours of work per week. Right now, among families with a married couple, so you have a mom and a dad and some kids, and those kinds of families now, on average, they're putting in one worker at full-time, full year, and another worker working most of the year at 31 hours a week. So really, we've seen a big change in how much time individuals have been working. We've seen a large increase in labor supply, especially among women and among mothers. But we've seen this shift within the household so that as we see around us, most parents are now working and they have less time off. One of the interesting things that we've put into this year's State of Working America is that we've tabulated how much time off American workers have versus other workers, and also here within this country among different kinds of jobs. And one of the things that we found is that over the last 20 years, Americans on average have lost a day of paid holiday time, have seen no rise in their vacation time, and have seen a loss in other kinds of benefits. So we're working harder and longer, and we're getting less paid time off.
And what about benefits? People are working harder. How much do they have to show for it?
Well, one of the good things over the boom was that people were seeing these real wage growth increases. What they weren't seeing was any increase in the amount of benefits that they're receiving. We saw a small increase in the health insurance coverage numbers, but we also saw that more people were having to pay for their health insurance. And of those who had to pay for their health insurance, those people who did have to pay were having to pay more out of pocket. So we saw that kind of benefit decreasing. We've also seen more people being taken, moving away from pensions, which is a defined benefit during retirement, towards these 401k or plans where people have to contribute to them year after year, a defined contribution plan. So we've seen an overall slowdown in the lowering in the amount of benefits that people have here in the United States.
And now, what about, you've been describing recessions in the service sector and job losses for women. The good economy of the late 1990s inspired a lot of pundits to declare welfare reform a great success because it appeared women are getting kicked off the rolls were finding jobs. How's that judgment surviving the recession?
Well, unfortunately, it's too early to tell how many folks who left welfare who found work are unemployed. We won't really have a good idea of how those folks have been hit for another at least 6 months to a year. But what we do know is that somewhat around a third of former welfare recipients found jobs in the retail trade sector, and that was one of the sectors that's been hit hard by the recession. So the conclusion is likely that many of these folks who moved from welfare to work have lost their jobs. And one of the things about welfare reform is that they instituted these five-year lifetime benefits on welfare receipt, which make it difficult for folks to go back on welfare. That combined with the fact that folks who moved from welfare to work, even during the economic boom of the late 1990s, are still less eligible than other workers to receive unemployment compensation. The unemployment compensation system looks at how much money you earned over the past year and how many hours you worked. And since these are former wealth recipients are pretty much by definition single moms, many of them have been working maybe 30 hours a week at low-wage jobs, and they just don't qualify for unemployment insurance. So I think there's a great deal of concern as to what's going on with these families and whether or not they are experiencing increased hardships. And we saw over the boom that even though many of them found jobs, they didn't find jobs at wages that allowed them to support their families necessarily. We saw an increase in hardships going without food or housing or necessary medical care among families who left and found full-time work over the course of the boom of the late 1990s. So one can only imagine that things are probably somewhat worse for these families now.
And finally, how did the various racial and gender gaps fare in the 90s? Did people catch up with white men, less fortunate demographics, or did the gaps remain?
Well, one of the things about the economic boom was that it was very democratic. Almost everybody benefited from it, which meant that the gaps didn't actually close all that much. We saw no closing of the gender pay gap and no real closing of the race gap, although we did see a closing. We did see that more African-American families own homes now, while the gap between white and African-American families is still very large. So really over the course of the boom, since everybody benefited, the gaps didn't close.
All right, that's it. Thank you for joining us, Heather Boucher.
Thank you so much,
Doug. You've had a busy week doing this, and thanks for helping us out here.
Okay, great.
Heather Boucher is a staff economist at the Economic Policy Institute and co-author, along with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein, of The State of Working America, 2002-2003, an absolutely essential volume that appears in even-numbered years from Cornell University Press, using research generated by the great folks at the Economic Policy Institute. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. Let's go out with a little bit more of the John Halley setting of the beautiful words of Larry Summers about how the economic logic of dumping vast loads of toxic waste in Africa is just impeccable. So we'll go out with that. And till next week, goodbye.